Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we're all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and will be here sooner than you think. My name is Stephen Gordon, and here in the Fast Forward Radio virtual studio is a very special guest, the one, the only, PJ Manny. Welcome, PJ.
Hello, Stephen. Thank you so much for having me back.
Oh, yeah, it's always fun. You're always a lot of fun, and I'm glad that you're co-hosting with me tonight. Yeah, not just a guest tonight, you're helping me keep this thing going because we have a notable absence tonight.
Yes, we do, but it's a wonderful and congratulatory absence.
That's right. Phil is once again a proud father. He was already a proud father before, but he is proud again. He's doubly proud. That's right. He had twins born since our last Fast Forward Radio show. Zara Grace Bauermaster and Kaylil Philip Bauermaster, a little boy, a little girl. And I laughed with him and said, you had that series, A New Phil, a while back. Well, we got a real new Phil now. And we got Zara Grace to go with him. And so I know that he and Sarai are just very, very proud, and we send out our truest congratulations and well wishes and everything else. Glad that mom and babies are doing great. So that's the reason Phil is not with us tonight, and so pretty good reason. I think,
it's the best reason of all, isn't it?
Anytime any of us have kids, I mean, I think that's kind of an automatic, get out of hot water for not being on Fast Forward Radio type thing. It doesn't get any better than that, right? So, anyway, our topic tonight, is basically a Yoda-inspired topic, right? I mean, Yoda, he was dealing with a couple of twins, too, like, right? Luke and Leia. Luke is in front of him wanting to go help Leia and the others. And, basically Luke's saying, well, if I don't go, they're going to die. And, he says, well, yes, but, you're going to mess everything up by going. And, well, and then he tries to look in the future. And so what does he say? Difficult to see. Always in motion, the future is. So, I think there's some real truth to that. I mean, we laugh sometimes at some of the believability of Star Wars, but I think is absolutely true. We don't have one future waiting out there in front of us that's, destined to happen. It seems that it's more like there's lots and lots of possibilities. So, I think that's our show tonight. I think that's what we're going to talk about. How has our views of the future changed over the years and even since last week? So, anyway, I guess I'll, throw this out to you, PJ. What events in your life have really led you to reevaluate the way things are going and what the future holds?
Well, probably the first thing I remember happening was the Apollo landing on the moon. And that, as a little kid, made a huge impression on me. I remember sitting in my den with my parents, my nose about 6 inches from the big color zenith we had, and being really stunned how different the world was. Now, I would have been, all of four or five at the time. But it made such an impression on me that we could go to the moon and that that was somehow a viable alternative from just living a normal life on Earth. One of the other big things I remember happening for me that really changed everything, sort of everything I knew, was I was lucky enough when I was a teenager, my parents were friends with George Lucas. And we got a tour of what was then called Sprocket Systems, but became Industrial Light and Magic. And I was at a very early CGI system watching the first, really a draft, if you will, of the Genesis planet from Star Trek.
Which was the very first
CGI sequence in film,
mm-hmm.
where it was completely CGI. So the entire transformation of the dead planet to the live planet was done through computer graphics. And this was like an early version of it, and he was explaining what was going to happen in this movie and how this entire scene was going to be created on a computer. And my parents were with me, and I was probably, I think I was probably about 15. And I remember looking at them and looking at the computer and looking at them and thinking, everything is going to change. And this is it. And this is the moment that media will change, that storytelling will change, that everything about the movies and television and visual images is going to change. Then, of course, actually in a funny connection to our Yoda, my mother walked by the Yoda puppet, and she goes, "What is that funny little creature?" Because, of course, she had never seen Star Wars, even though she was friends with George and his wife at the time, Marcia. And I'm like, "Oh, Mom, gosh, that's Yoda. I can't believe you don't know that." As a 15-year-old does. So deeply embarrassed,
so
wanting to die.
I'm learning this, PJ. I've got a new teenager. I don't think that boys get quite as embarrassed of their parents as girls do. You tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I still manage to embarrass my oldest sometimes. It's kind of funny. But
I think you're right about girls and boys. My daughter often talks about, you know, not just her, but how her friends are embarrassed by their parents too. And I never really hear it much from Nathaniel or his friends.
Yeah. I don't think they're quite as easily mortified, but
I don't think I don't even think they hear it. I don't think it even registers.
Maybe not. They're on some other, you know, they're thinking about something else entirely. But anyway,
exactly.
That's funny. The thing that you would be mortified about, PJ, gives you even more geek cred with us, you know. So, you know, the fact that your mom didn't know who Yoda was, that's just perfect. I love that.
So those were small things. And for me, I was always into science fiction. So the ideas of the future were always percolating in my head, you know, and I come by it, honestly, my father was a science fiction junkie, I was a science fiction junkie, was reading it all the time. So the notion that there were these different potential scenarios that could happen, that, you know, something based on something we're doing right now could spin out into a variety of different possibilities, was always with me. I can't actually think of a time, you know, since Apollo, that notion wasn't around for me. But, you know, I guess...
That's the phrase, isn't it? You know, whenever somebody talks about doing something difficult, it's always, well, we put a man on the moon, didn't we? You know?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if we can do that, you know, what is impossible? You know, I mean, very little seems impossible anymore. It's just a matter of applying the right pressure, I guess, to make something happen. So,
right.
Absolutely changes everything. I completely agree. I have talking about small things that, you know, kind of change your outlook. When I went off to college, I got a what amounted to an eight, I think it was the 8088 IBM compatible kind of thing. You know, we're talking very early computer. But it was still, you know, better than, you know, what a lot of the guys in the dorm had at that time. And, you know, it's just a small, I mean, absolutely, you know, no one had heard of the internet. You know, I managed to get through college before I heard of the internet. You know, a lot of our younger listeners would have a hard time even understanding what, you know, what do you mean? I mean, you know, in the internet, you have to have the internet for college. Well, actually, boys and girls, no, you don't.
So true.
A lot of us made it through college without the internet. But anyway, basically what I had was, you know, this computer, and and what could it do of use? You know, well, it was a word processor, and, you know, maybe a few other little things, but mostly it was a word processor. I used it to type, you know, papers and things that I turned in. But the thing that really, you know, impressed me is such a simple thing was the ability to, you know, I could type just, you know, I could just, you know, have sort of a free-ranging, you know, just throw it out there on the screen kind of thing. And then just cut and paste and delete and move things around. And, you know, after a while it started looking good. And, you know, that ability to polish, you know, was a huge leap forward from, you know, what people were doing with typewriters before.
Yes.
Or writing it out with longhand and then literally cutting the page and pasting it. You know, I've literally seen people do that too, particularly back then in college. They would, I had some.
That's what I did.
Yeah, and you just write it out longhand.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Literally cut it and you know, put it in different order and stuff that way. It was you know, it was bizarre what we had to do before computers. So that I began to see, you know, computers are a useful thing. They're not just a toy at that point. Because before then, you know, I'd had a computer, you know, basically it was just a toy. It was something that we just kind of fiddled with. Useful work, that was really the first time I ever used a computer for useful work. And obviously I've never stopped since then. So, and I what was the year? That was about 1986 when that happened. So that was, you know, a big leap forward in the way I viewed the future.
I think for me the biggest leap, I guess, for me to get to where I am today was when I decided to write this book about nanotechnology, cognitive technologies, and I started doing all this research. And this is probably back in 2006, and I discovered this group of people who I'd never heard of before called transhumanists.
Yeah.
And I remember lurking in their chat rooms and thinking, oh, they call themselves this strange name. But they're talking about stuff that I've certainly thought about, you know, I've through reading science fiction, et cetera, and wanting to write this story. And for me, coming in contact with this entire culture of futurists and transhumanists, that radically changed a lot of my thinking because, number one, I was actually discovering the research of what was actually happening, and knowing where research actually was mind expanding. You know, that people were even back then were, you know, been working on brain prosthetics and brain computer interfaces and some of the longevity medicine that people were working on at the time. That was stunning to me. That was actually all happening and being not just theorized, but, you know, actual lab work being done.
Yeah.
I think that and you know, and I know I don't want to jump on yours because I know you have you reading Kurzweil, you found reading Ray's work a very inspiring thing, but so did I. I remember, you know, reading, and it was probably the same book. What was the book that you found so?
Well, the one that really, I mean, this was about 2003, I believe. I read The Age of Spiritual Machines, It just absolutely blew my mind. I mean, because, you know, as I was reading it, I just really connected with the book. It made sense. I mean, he makes a really, if you understand, you know, the implication of Moore's Law, and then in the broader sense, how Moore's Law really fits into, really, it seems to be a law of nature, basically, that nature tends to organize in ways that are more and more profound as time goes on. And Moore's Law just kind of is part of this. And then, you know, where are we going? Well, pretty soon we see greater than human intelligence, you know, going down this path. And then once you have then all bets are off. And I mean, you know, and he doesn't say it that quickly. I mean, obviously you're reading into it several chapters, and then he's laying out the argument piece by piece. But you know, when it all falls into place, I go, oh my gosh, this is huge. This is the big, you know, surely other people are talking about this book. Well, you know, get out on the internet, and yes, lots of people were talking about it, and ran into Phil that way, and we've been writing The Speculist ever since together.
That's
so
how you guys met?
Yeah, absolutely. I got out looking for people of you know, like-minded folks that had read that book, and came across Phil, and that's it. So.
Wow. Well, yeah. For me, I read both The Age of Spiritual Machines and The Singularity is Near at the same time, back to back, because I'd never read Kurzweil, and
yeah.
It was.
That must have been about 2005, huh?
About 2005, 2006, and because I think I stopped lurking sometime in 2006, sometime around then, and
dove in both.
Yeah, boy, did I dive in. funny how you see the always in motion is the future. I would never have guessed that would have been my future. But I found it so compelling, in even just the simplicity of accelerating change. That notion was utterly compelling for me, and something I had never, in essence, had taken for granted. I'd never seen anybody map it out so clearly before, and that affected that. I think moved me from being simply a participant in the future like everyone is, to trying to take an active part in talking about it.
Yeah.
Because the combination of Kurzweil and, for me, the Tofflers with Future Shock, that's a potent combo, because it's all well and good to accept the notion of accelerating change, but if people around you don't understand that that's in fact what's happening, you have Future Shock. And we're seeing everything Toffler wrote about in the 70s come to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And that, they're like a 1-2 punch, if you will, of futurist thought. And that really concerned me, that, you know, people become fearful when they don't understand what's happening. And that's
what
moved
when
me.
People become- And when people become fearful, then, you know, they start, you know, demanding for, you know, bad laws.
Right.
It takes society in the wrong direction. And then, you know, if we advocate, we decide we're not going to have these technologies, then does that stop it from developing? Absolutely not.
Well, exactly correct.
Yeah, we may be out of the game, but it's taking place elsewhere. And that only puts us in a worse position. So, yeah, it's much, much better to kind of be the Paul Revere's. Talk about something that's current. But anyway, we're the Paul Revere's, warning everybody, right, that it's, you know, these things, it's not just what we have now that we need to be thinking about. We put it to you this way. When I was being taught how to fly an airplane, This was very important as a lesson to me. He said, basically, my flight instructor was telling me, you know, with a car, you can safely drive a car if you just are looking out ahead of you, you know, maybe a football field at the most. You can generally you can safely pilot a vehicle. With an airplane, you need to be thinking much further ahead. You're moving much faster, particularly when you're coming in for landing. You need to be thinking out ahead. You need to be flying out ahead of the aircraft. You can't be flying in the pilot seat. You need to be flying way out. You know, your brain, your mind, what you're thinking is way out ahead of it, so that it can't get away from you. That's exactly, you know, what we kind of need to pilot the future. I mean, we need to be thinking out ahead so that, you know, there are ethical things we need to be thinking about. There are, you know, what are we going to do with these with some of these intelligences that are when they're sentient? I mean, seems to me we shouldn't treat them as slaves. You know, there should be some things we need to be thinking about along those lines. And so, yeah, I mean, that's we need to be piloting this thing out in front of it, right?
Yes, absolutely. And the flip side of that is, how do we make sure they don't treat us as slaves?
Exactly. Maybe by treating them well, we hope. Right. You know, we don't teach them bad habits by treating them bad. So yeah,
right. You know, so that really became, for me, it was a great mind opening about bioethics, technoethics, the questions we need to ask ourselves, our society, about what is it we're going to do with this, because it's going to happen regardless of whether we want it to happen or not. If it can be conceived, it will be created. And
well, tell me just a little bit real quick about the about some of those programs you saw being developed regarding, like, you know, prosthetics and things. You saw some of that up close?
Yeah, I saw some really interesting things. You know, some of it is, well, for instance, I never got to his lab because in this particular case, but I read all of his research because he very wisely keeps out of the spotlight. But there's a researcher at University of Southern California named Ted Berger who is building a prosthetic hippocampus. And his
wow.
Research is, yeah, it's extraordinary. For use in diseases like Alzheimer's, where the hippocampus is particularly vulnerable to the lesions and Swiss cheese effect that can happen to the brain. And the hippocampus, of course, is the part of the brain where we create memories. And I was particularly interested in this because I wanted to write about this, which I ended up doing, because the notion that we could create a hippocampus was, you know, revelatory, especially because what he's doing is he's taking, you know, wetware, our brains, an analog system, to say the least.
Yeah. It doesn't get more analog than that, yeah.
And yet was able to replicate neural activity across a digital bridge and then back again. So
incredible.
That was, you know, that was really incredible to me. And, you know, and this is very slow research, and it's part of what I have such
research,
respect for the patience of these people.
They fully expect to be working on this probably the rest of their lives, some of these guys, but it's that's amazing work. The reason I asked is because Brian Wong just posted yesterday on these University of Chicago researchers that are developing prosthetics that not only you move with your mind just like you would your regular arm or something, but also give them a sense of touch. They're able to feel with these prosthetic limbs. And
this has been in the works for years. I mean, again, this kind
stuff
of research.
Been coming a while. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, some of this research was originated out of DARPA and DARPA money. Some of it didn't. A lot of it obviously is what's the best way to put this? You know, a war medical research, because we have a lot of people who need this.
Right. A lot of people coming home from Iraq.
Exactly. Exactly.
Coming home without all their limbs. They call it, and I think that they were, at one point they were calling it, here's another Star Wars reference, they were calling it the Luke Skywalker Project. The idea is to make something that it looks just like Luke Skywalker's hand at the end of the same movie, Empire Strikes Back. It looks exactly the same. He's able to feel with it and use it just like any other hand. And, you know, the movie that followed that one, you know, Return of the Jedi, the fact that he had a robot hand was of no consequence to anything he had to do in the follow-up movie, was it? I mean,
it was a psychological consequence.
There you go.
Which becomes the ethics issue.
Okay, that's deep, PJ. I can see that now. Yeah, but yeah, it's these things with prosthetics have been coming a long time, and you know, there's obviously a limited market for it. This is talk about another ethical issue. What happens when the prosthetics get better than our normal body parts? Do we start? What do we do then? Yeah. So.
Well, this is a classic bioethics dilemma, which is, and this was back when they thought that people like Oscar Pretorius could run faster than full body humans. For your listeners, Oscar Pretorius is the South African runner who, through, I believe it was childhood disease, lost the bottom of both his legs from below the knee. Mm-hmm. And he has the famous cheetah legs, which are these extraordinary-looking bands of, I think, titanium, but bands of metal, which he can run on. And he runs extremely fast. He's among one of the fastest people in the world. But he is not the fastest person in the world. And they've done a lot of studies with him to see if he actually has an advantage or a disadvantage. And I've seen it sort of tossed up both ways. He uses less energy, which is interesting, running, but it doesn't necessarily mean that is actually enough of an advantage. He may use less energy, but he also has less to use energy upon.
Right.
So
right.
it's hard to see if that's actually a reason. But, you know, bioethicists were saying, well, but what happens if people start cutting off their legs because they want to run as fast as Oscar Pretorius?
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to happen a lot. Call me crazy.
And it won't. You know, there was somebody, I think this was actually, and this is like within the last month or so, a young man I think he might be 30, but he voluntarily got an amputation of one of his hands. It was basically the hand was useless to him. It had been injured to the point that it was there. It looked like a normal human hand, but it was absolutely of zero function to him. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, basically the doctor said, well, you know, we can do amazing things now with prosthetics that would be more useful to you than this hand. What do you say? And he voluntarily had the amputation, and now is using a prosthetic that allows him to grip things, and this is one of these prosthetics that, is controlled with his mind, not just the old hook that, you know, so many people use for so many years. This is one of these prosthetics he's using, and apparently he's happier with that than with the hand that was useless to him. So,
but that's not really enhancement. That is a therapeutic device because he didn't have functionality before. I find it hard to believe people will take perfectly functional legs and remove them.
Right. Absolutely. And there's a vast difference between what this man did and what you're talking about. But it still raised some eyebrows because it's, you know, generally in the past, I mean, as long as the, it's not going to go gangrenous on you or something,
right.
Have some sort of, you know, people would tend to keep their body parts, you know, even if it was useless, it would just, you know, at least it's still, you know, me, I've still got it. But he said, no, I really need a useful hand. And he elected to have a prosthetic instead. So,
well, we're seeing an increase just in the last 20 years of this willingness to be cyborg, the cyborgization, certainly in both medicine and, you know, in society, with people with cochlear implants and pacemakers and, you know, deep brain stimulation, that there is a willingness to replace the parts that need replacing. I personally don't see a problem with it. And as people's lives are saved and improved, I think society will increasingly not see a problem with it as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, talk about something else that kind of changes your outlook on what the future could be. How about the printing of that kidney at that TED Talk? You know,
that was awesome.
Absolutely incredible. Right there on the stage, let's print a kidney. And, I'm kind of big on the whole Fab Lab 3D printers anyway. To me, that's just extremely cool. You know, when you're printing a ballpoint pen or a comb or anything that, you know, that alone is pretty cool. But then when you start doing medically to print organs that you need, that's pretty awesome too. And I guess I'm going to point to another Brian Wong article he wrote just a couple of days ago, Promising Hurdles to printed Organs and Some Printed Replacement Parts will be in trials by 2013 and are expected to be in use by 2016. Guys, we're talking, you know, that's like 4 and 5 years from now. That's right around the bend. So that's pretty big. You know, when parts of us start wearing out and we're able to replace them, you know, particularly if we're doing it with, you know, our own adult stem cells and things like that. If
exactly
we're,
right.
Cultivating those stem cells, you know, printing out the parts that we need and then going in and putting them in. You know, that's a big thing with getting a replacement organ now if it's donated by, you know, somebody, living or otherwise, is that, you know, then you got problems with the rejection and you're on those anti-rejection medicines the rest of your life, which basically, what does it do? It keeps your immune system weak. And therefore you're going to get sick a lot. So that's just not the best way to go.
Well, and many people feel that who have transplants, especially younger people, that they've in essence traded one disease for another.
And
because
that's exactly
it is so problematic.
Yeah. And you know, if the disease that they traded was, you know, a heart that was about to give out on them for this, then it's a good trade, but still, it's just a huge amount of problems associated with that. If, on the other hand, you can make a brand new heart with your own adult stem cells, and it is your heart, and it goes into your chest and places the bad one, then, you know, that's a huge step forward, and you know that will change a lot of change the way a lot of people will think about their futures when this stuff starts rolling out and.
Absolutely.
And it would appear in just the next few years. So that's pretty awesome.
Absolutely. And in regards to stem cells, I have to say the one development I find the most extraordinary is this notion that we can even inject stem cells into the brain and rebuild neural tissue. I believe there's a researcher from Harvard who's been working on that, where going into brains with Alzheimer's that have large, you know, pieces of it missing, to be able to put stem cells in those lesion holes and watch new neurons grow and bridge those gaps. Now, you're not going to get back, clearly you're not going to get back the information that was held in those neurons that disappeared, but at least you're going to have bridges that can talk from one set of neurons to another again.
Exactly, and so that the person can then rebuild.
Exactly.
And, you know, they're not stuck in the state they're in, or in the case of Alzheimer's, a continually worsening state. You know, I'm going to tell you, I've been very, seen up close and personal what Alzheimer's does to people. It's just sad. I mean, that,
tragic.
I can't. It is absolutely tragic because you're losing the person you love right in front of you, and there's,
mm-hmm.
it goes on and on and on. It's not, and it's an ongoing tragedy. It's just terrible. To have to live through that as the person, I'm sure, and then as the people who love that person. It's just a tough, tough deal. Ditto with strokes. It takes away so much. And if we give people the opportunity to rebuild, sure, you've lost a lot, but now you're going to have a healthy brain again, and you can relearn these things. Well, then that's just, that's awesome. That is absolutely awesome. And so that touches people on a very personal level. So, yeah.
I wish I had the patience that these guys have in their research, because I see the potential of these things, and I just can't wait for them to happen.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about one potentially negative thing. Albus Bridges, I follow him on Twitter, and
he's a good friend of mine.
And he's been on the show a few times. He's brilliant. We love to have him. He's and has always is challenging us with every time he's on here. But he's McDonald's May U.S. sales are hurt by high gas prices, he said. And Alvis says, and what we need is robot cheeseburger delivery services, so we don't have to deal with the high gas prices. absolutely. I give me my robot cheeseburger delivery service. In fact, if it makes the cheeseburger cheaper, hey, make the whole thing, from start to finish, done by robots. The downside, obviously, is that wouldn't that cause a bit of an employment problem? I mean, all these people that are working for McDonald's and delivery truck drivers and everything else.
But we're seeing it already, Stephen. I mean, that's the big problem we have right now, is that between automation and increased efficiencies, there are more and more people and fewer jobs. Because we are automating things. So what's going to happen? I have to be honest with you. That's probably one of my biggest fears. Everyone talks about existential risk and the end of the species. I'm more worried about what lack of employment might do.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people think that, well, this is silly to worry about this. But, when Watson beat the human champions on Jeopardy, I'm thinking to myself, well, those guys are pretty smart. And, I'm pretty sure they're smarter than me. And a machine just beat them in general knowledge. Exactly what are we going to bring? What do we humans bring to the table in a few years when, Watson is shrunk down and he's walking around on metal legs and in our workplace? It's not just the guys that are flipping cheeseburgers and working on the automobile manufacturing lines that need to worry. I think knowledge workers, just a couple of years after that, are going to be
absolutely
looking forward as well.
And one of the things that people have often said is, well, the people will always need the creative workers. It's not just the knowledge workers, it's the people who are actually, the creatives who are creating things, be it verbally, musically, visually, et cetera. Well, I've just, in the last few years seen incredible AIs that can compose music.
Right.
So does that put the composers out of work? Especially in my industry, in film and television, the amount of automation and the radical speed at which that is accelerating. Movies in the old days, first of all, had enormous pieces of equipment. It took you years to become expert on how to use them. And it took many, many people to make, with a lot of physical labor, enormous amount of physical labor, to move these enormous cameras and these enormous lights and these big microphone systems. you know, now everything can be held in the palm of your hand. And can be edited by that person digitally on their, you know, Final Cut Pro. It's made the price of filmmaking, you know, in general, some filmmaking has absolutely increased, but those are the kinds of filmmaking that do the R&D to create new technologies.
Right.
So the $200 million movies, I mean, they're still creating new technologies that will eventually become quite cheap to use. But, you know, digital filmmaking is now unbelievably cheap, and everybody could become their own filmmaker. Well, is there going to become a point where that can get most of that can get farmed out to an AI as well?
Well, when you know, talking about the creative mind, I mean, we've got AIs now that are proposing experiments, performing the experiments, and discovering new things in science. I mean,
right.
I guess I suppose there's someone that's sitting there and writing it down and publishing this stuff in journals and stuff, you know, but it's actually the machine that's deciding, okay, let's figure out this problem, you know, and figure out a solution to this, you know, an automated scientist, you know, I mean, that's you know, pretty awesome. Technology. So it's, you know, one of the wildest things you hear from Ray Kurzweil is that, you know, we'll join with our technology. You know, you begin to understand why we might, you know.
Well,
you know,
because what else will we do?
Can't beat them, join them, right?
Well,
so,
you know, and I even just look at it psychologically because, you know, people often talk about, you know, what are the things that make us happy? Well, we really need a few basic things to make people happy. And one of them is, you know, to love and be loved, to have people that love you and that you love back. But the other thing is work that you find value in, that you feel is that you're bringing something to, that you're receiving something from. And work, I think people forget that work is one of the things that gives us satisfaction. Well, what if we can't do the work that satisfies us anymore?
Yeah, I mean, we don't, you know, that's we will not relinquish the top rung of the ladder without, you know, that just doesn't, you know, once you've been at the top and you're the species that's doing all these great and creative and neat things, to just sit back and retire as a species and just say, you know, we're not, you know, we'll just pursue our own comfort now. I don't see us doing that. I think that's what's going to cause us to want to, you know, upgrade our minds or whatever we need to do to stay in the game. And that's why I think it would happen. And, you know, we all have this picture. Well, we got these wires coming out of our skull. I don't think it'll go like that. I hope not. We won't turn into the Borg. I think it'll be a lot more subtle than that. But it's pretty profound change there. And I think that's why we would do it is we simply don't want to be left out when all these cool things are being done.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it doesn't get more profound than that. Where do we go from there?
I've got a question for you that I often never get to ask people who think about the future, and that is, does your thinking about the future affect how your children think about it? Because they are the future.
Right.
And I'm always curious, you know, people like you and I spent a great deal of our time thinking about some pretty esoteric stuff.
Yeah.
And do you think that growing up amongst us makes our children more aware of the future?
I would say absolutely. For one thing, they listen to the show. You know, so
your kids are better than mine. Mine don't listen to the show.
Well, did they get embarrassed of mom on the show? Is that it? particularly my two older ones. It might be too, you know, with my younger two, it may be a little early to say, but the older two are complete geeks. They love this kind of stuff. I'm always mailing them tweets that I think would be interesting. My oldest, Timothy, is just, I mean, everything about robots is just fascinating to him. And so I'm always, things about that. And he reads the Speculus. So absolutely, I would say yes, it very much does. It does. And, you know, we homeschool our children. And one of the things we do, one of the things I do is try to, in addition to the normal stuff that he's learning, just like the kids that go to school, I try to throw in like a lot of this stuff and just challenge him to think outside the box a little bit. You know, where are these things going? And we'll sit and have conversations exactly like what you and I are having, PJ. Both of the two older ones, they surprise me a lot. They understand where things are going sometimes better than I do. They've got a 3DS, the Nintendo handheld, the latest Nintendo handheld thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea that this was what they were doing with it, but it's an augmented reality gaming system is part of what it is. And you'll be looking at the screen, and it's got cameras on the back of the unit, and like so you're seeing the table in front of you on the screen, and like little creatures and things are running around on the table, augmented reality kind of thing, okay? And you know you might be trying to shoot them, it depends on the game, they were in there having an animated discussion about where augmented reality was going, I absolutely think that talking to your kids about this sort of stuff is important. And I think it does have an effect on them. I mean, they think about these things if you're talking with them about it. What about with your kid? I know you've got one that's a teenager also, right?
Oh, I've got a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old. And
yeah.
My 15-year-old is very science-oriented. I'd say he's more theoretically oriented than, let's say, applied sciences. He's, as in a very age-appropriate way, he wants to be a cosmologist. But I do remember when he was in middle school, he must have been having conversations on the playground because he'd come home and say things like, "My friend Nikki doesn't think that if nanotechnology happens, that we could actually merge with computers." And he'd say, "Can you explain to me again why?" I think he was probably about, 12 or 13 or something like that. And so he'd say, so how come you think this is going to happen, Mom?" So I'd explain. And, I assumed he got back somehow to the playground. or he'd come home and he'd say, "One of my friends doesn't buy that we're going to have like these really really big increases in longevity." And
yeah.
I would have to explain, if you look at it from the medicine we have today, no, we're probably, based on what we've got today, we're not going to increase our longevity. But if we have these changes in medicine and this is the direction it's going, et cetera. So, that would be the end of the conversation, and then he'd disappear. And, and I assume since I never heard any follow-up that somehow it would have been translated on the playground. So I feel like in my part, I'm doing my little part to expand the horizons of a bunch of, at that point, middle schoolers.
your transhumanist ideas are polluting the playground there.
There you go. But,
that's great.
My daughter, I think, is a little more eye-rolling involved. Maybe because she actually...
Mom, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, again, maybe the girl thing. I think for her, she is less interested in the literal aspects of it than, possibly my son. But, I think just by being around it, they certainly have a lot of exposure to it. And certainly from, you know, being around friends of mine who've come that they've met, they see this, mom is thinking about this stuff. But I don't know, you know, I don't believe they've actually tried to Google me. I don't think they've listened to any of these podcasts. I don't know if their curiosity is quite there yet. And I certainly didn't say, listen to my podcast. So.
That's awesome. That's awesome. But, like you say, get these ideas out there because, it seems like, it doesn't seem like it. It is. The world is changing faster and faster, and future shock is going, is going to hit some people hard. And the main thing we need to be concerned about, I think, is when those things start happening, the backlash could be something that actually hurts us and keeps us from reaching our full potential. So, the better we are prepared or the better we're thinking ahead, the better we will be in the long run, I think. So,
absolutely.
Thanks for doing your part, BJ.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I am doing just more generally than just with my own children. Within our schools, I've been working very hard in improving and broadening the science programs, getting telepresence in our schools so that we can not just take advantage of what other schools are teaching, but other things all over the country and the world so that we can bring all of that into the classroom, not just through the internet, but through direct conversation with people, be it at NASA or, wherever. I've been trying very hard to get our schools to teach up-to-date material. That's really hard. To get them to understand that you need to introduce a little bit of nanotechnology in your curriculum, because that's not a science, that's a tool. And that's a tool that everyone is going to be using in every branch of science. So if kids don't understand the science of the very small, that's to their detriment.
Absolutely. Well, let me just throw out, to prove, to illustrate that point, I'm going to just throw out this one story I read. Nanoparticle design is the perfect size and shape to penetrate tumors and carries with it, it's molecularly tied to photodynamic therapy. So these nanoparticles, you inject them and they go all over your body, but they are, because of their size and shape, they end up collecting in tumors. Then you throw a special type of light on it, and it kills the tumor. So nanotech obviously is going to be for everything. But I mean, in medicine alone, it's going to be huge, and it really already is.
In medicine and engineering, in every form of applied science. And that to me, I think every kid, like how kids have embraced robots, I think kids would embrace the notion of molecular engineering, that you could, look at these, at a 3D printer. Kids look at 3D printers and go, wow, that is so awesome. Well, when you can start 3D printing at the atomic level, then what extraordinary things they're going to be able to do. But I think it's also to capture the imaginations of these kids. Kids know Legos. They understand the notion of taking this, and it clicks onto that. And this one doesn't fit, but that one does. And what does that create? I can't wait to see what these kids who've been raised on Legos do with nanotechnology.
Absolutely, absolutely. It could be in medicine, like you say. There's just so many different possibilities. It's hard to even know where they might go with it. It's an incredible set of tools. Like you say, it's not a science. It's something that can be used in any science. So, absolutely.
But I'd love kids, at young ages, to understand that this is what's coming. because I also love how young kids still think outside the box. They don't know so much that they think they know what can and can't be accomplished. And I have to say, I've loved these stories, I don't know if you've been seeing them lately, of young people doing these science fair experiments where they, you know, one person found two drugs that were being used for cystic fibrosis, and he said, I wonder what would happen if you use these drugs together.
Yes,
and he did
yeah.
a clinical test that shows that no one had ever realized that those drugs together worked X percentage better than either of the drugs apart. There have been so many fabulous breakthroughs that young people have been engineering because they don't know what they
don't know so much
that they feel boxed in intellectually.
Yeah, that's right. They don't know it. They don't know yet that it can be done. So
exactly.
They just do it. Yeah, that's awesome. Let me just throw out one more thing that could be a complete game changer regarding just, you know, our whole civilization. There is a development in battery design. It's a thing called Cambridge Crude. I don't know if you saw that this
no.
week, PJ. What it is, they're calling it Cambridge Crude. It's being developed where it's – what it is this, it's a gunk, okay, or you could call it, it's like a gel that you could, you know, it goes in a battery. It has all the electricity in it, and you would run it like a regular, you know, for a car or something like that. You'd run down the highway just like a normal battery, except for it holds 10 times as much electricity as a standard battery, and since it's a gel, you could fill up at a filling station with it, and you know
you could
once you have that, and you could take it home and then plug it into the socket at home and recharge the gel too. But if you're if you need to quickly get a new tank of energy, you just get rid of the old gel and put in the new gel. Calling it Cambridge Crude, and I'll put a link in the chat room. Absolutely. A game changer. If that were to work out, then you know that changes everything, seems to me, and our view of the future changes with it.
That's amazing. Yeah, I keep on telling my son, you know, cosmology is great, but you know, energy science, that's really good.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you like me going to energy science?
Yeah, there's going to be some interesting things to find out in that area, too. Absolutely, absolutely. Well, we're just about out of time, aren't we?
Yes, indeed.
Yes. Well, my normal music source was down. Music Alley is upgrading their system, and so I had to look elsewhere for music and came across an interesting thing. PJ, a website called ccmixter.org, and what it is, it's just a, you know, people will not just share the song, but they'll also share MP3s of all the tracks of the song, so that if somebody has an idea of how to make it sound more interesting or do something different with it, they can, you know, take out one track and put in another and have a totally different sounding piece of music. And you know, I listened through a lot of it. Some of it sounds like Frankenstein. You know, I mean, it's pieced together in a way that doesn't really quite work. But some of it is just pretty outstanding, and that's an interesting way for people to collaborate. You know, and anyway, I thought I'd play a piece of music from that website. It's the website again is ccmixter.org, ccmixter.org. I invite everybody to check it out. It's kind of interesting. The name of this song is Hear Me Now by Scott Anthem and presumably many other people. And so, at any rate, thank you very much, PJ, for being on the show tonight. As always, you fascinating, fun, and good host. So I appreciate you joining me tonight.
Thank you.
I couldn't imagine doing it alone. It's just not the kind of show you do alone. You have to have somebody to bounce these ideas off of. Appreciate you.
Well, it's been wonderful fun. Thanks so much.
Okay. All right. Hear Me Now by Scott Anthem. Good night.
The closet never died, the closet still blew.